Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
The Slate Political Gabfest is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. Casper mattresses come with free delivery and returns within a 100-day period. And get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/political and using the promo code POLITICAL. And by stamps.com, buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer and save up to 80% compared to a postage meter. Sign up for a no-risk trial and a $110 bonus offer when you visit stamps.com and use the promo code GABFEST. And by Bonobos. Bonobos takes the pain and hassle out of finding stylish clothes that fit. For a limited time, all new customers can get 20% off their first order at bonobos.com/GABFEST. That's bonobos.com/GABFEST. Discover the difference that an expertly crafted, better-fitting wardrobe can make.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for October 9th, 2015. The Would You Like to Be Speaker of the House edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine, hello, is in New Haven. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
And John Dickerson of Face the Nation. And Slate is in New York. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
So we are scattered to the winds, not unlike the Republican House conference. On this week's Gabfest, we are just moments after the chaos has fallen upon House Republicans as Kevin McCarthy has announced he will not run for Speaker. What's going to happen in Congress? Then the first Democratic presidential debate is next week. We will preview it. Who's going to win? And then poor Jeb Bush. Oh, things are not going well for him. Can his brother save him? Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And in Slate Plus, do accents help you in politics? Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are testing this proposition. If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, you can get it by going to slate.com/GABFEST Plus. Hey, also, I'm not sure you guys are aware of this. The Superfest tickets are going on sale. We are doing a live show on November 16th in New York, and it's going to be with the Slate Cult Fest and Hang Up and Listen. We're doing it at Town Hall in New York. It's going to be a huge, awesome group show. It's going to be super fun. That's why we're calling it the Super Fest, because it's going to be super fun. And you can get tickets at slate.com/SuperFestNYC. And there are, in fact, there are package tickets for a show and after party. If you want to pay a bit extra, you can get after party partying. You can come party. So I hope we'll see you there. As we are recording on Thursday afternoon, wow, there's a real-life news happening. There's news happening. We learned just a couple hours ago that Kevin McCarthy, the presumptive new House Speaker, has presumptively himself out the door. He has decided not to run for Speaker. He announced that today. He announced it to his Republican colleagues. And it has thrown the whole question of the future of the House leadership into disarray. McCarthy seems to have dropped out because he was facing some of the same forces that Boehner faced, which is the sense that he was too compromised and that the very conservative elements of the House, notably this shadowy House Freedom Caucus. We're all in the House Freedom Caucus in America, but the House Freedom Caucus was going to oppose him. So John, is there any reason to think that there's anything sinister behind his decision not to run for Speaker? Is there anything beyond this is going to be a really hard job? I don't really have the full support of my party, and therefore I better just not do it, and somebody else can do it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, anytime you get something that's this surprising, one searches for alternative explanations, and perhaps in the end there will be some, you know, other shoe to drop.
Although there's usually someone is having an affair, would be my experience. But anyway,
he's staying on as majority leader, which means if there was some other shoe to drop, presumably that would hurt him in that job too. So, I mean, I think without really answering that question, the fact that he would need, I mean, based on the conversations I've had, the fact that he would need 218 votes from Republicans to become Speaker, because they weren't going to do it, he wasn't going to try and win with any Democratic votes, was just going to be too difficult. And the commitments he was going to have to make to the Freedom Caucus, or the Hell No Caucus, as they are sometimes called, were things that he just couldn't deliver. He also told Rich Lowry of the National Review that if he forced a vote, he was going to make friends of his take a tough vote to support him, because they were already hearing from their constituents at home. The grassroots had been whipped up and been told that McCarthy was just another John Boehner, about which they weren't totally wrong in terms of his ideological view and his rational view on the fact that with a Democratic president and a Senate in which 60 votes are required to pass legislation, you cannot pass and make and turn into law incredibly conservative legislation. So, you know, those were a combination of things. I mean, some of the members of the Freedom Caucus that I talked to after Boehner left said, what we want the new speaker to do is just take on Mitch McConnell and get him to change the filibuster rules in the Senate so that Democrats can't block legislation with 60 votes. When you're asking for the House Speaker to determine the rules of the Senate, that's a really heavy request. That just, you know, it's, I mean, most
also,
people...
I would also point out that still doesn't get legislation passed because there is a Democratic president.
Right. And also, by the way, just one other little wrinkle is that it could very well be the case that the Democrats regain the majority after 2016, in which case the filibuster rules are going to be something that Republicans are going to be really anxious to have. So anyway, it's the requests from the Freedom Caucus were pretty heavy. We don't know all of the things they requested from McCarthy, but one thing that's interesting in the conversations I had after Boehner, there were two schools of thought. One thought that the Freedom Caucus would kind of say, okay, we've gotten our scalp, we're going to play nice and work with the new guy. And there's another school that said they're going to be ever more grabby because they've seen the success they had in getting Boehner out, and it looks like that is what they did or have done, and now they've gotten rid of McCarthy as well.
So, all right, given all this, Emily, it is obviously too early to predict who the next House Speaker will be, but let's just do it anyway, because why not?
You're asking me that question?
No, not really, but John was just talking for a long time, so I just thought, like, now it's Emily's
turn. Well, so here's what I want to talk about instead, since I could just, like, tell you what the names are on Twitter.
John has more things to say than either of us combined.
Forget it.
Go ahead.
So I am suddenly completely interested in this race, which I couldn't have cared less about before this happened, and the reason is, do you remember months ago, David, you were talking about this kind of fabulous constitutional crisis scenario in which Stephen Breyer or Justice Ginsburg retires or dies right this minute, Obama can't get someone approved. Scalia. You're right. It's even better if it's Scalia or Kennedy or someone in the conservative majority that would change the balance of the court. Sorry, I didn't give you enough credit. So that is such a great puzzle to think through, because the institution, the constitutional structure for our government would force a real moment of truth that would reveal something about these political divisions we live with every day. And I feel like that's what this moment is. So are these 50 hell no Freedom Caucus people going to run the party? Because I don't know. If the answer is yes, then we're going to have their pick, this guy from Florida named, I believe, well, his last name
Daniel
is
Webster.
Webster.
His name is Daniel Webster.
Okay, that
is
I was going to say
that's
that.
An honorable
it just seems
name
too
to
crazy.
Have if you're a,
yeah,
if you're
okay,
an American
his name really is Daniel Webster,
leader.
Just like the famous representative from New England who either David or John can give a mini history lesson about. I mean, okay, and then what happens? Like, then we have this nihilistic House Speaker who actually, what, like, shuts down the government every 5 seconds to defund Planned Parenthood or for whatever other excitement the right wing of the party cooks up? Or, I mean, is the other option some kind of bipartisan speaker, which seems to be completely unacceptable to the Republicans who would run for the job for reasons I completely understand? I mean, they would get a challenge from the right. They would be primaried. Plus, the fact it just, I think, goes against their own principles to imagine such a bipartisan House. And yet that's suddenly the stark choice that it seems like has been foisted on them and the country. And I just can't wait to see what happens next.
Right. John, I mean, it sounds like, in the initial early tip sheet, there's this hope, well, Paul Ryan, who would probably be acceptable to lots and lots of people, including most conservatives, just refuses to put his name in there. He doesn't want the job. And he's the House Budget Committee Chair.
And who can blame him? Surely he'd become the next pinata, like the day after tomorrow.
But if there's no Ryan, there doesn't seem to be anybody with a huge amount of gravity in the party. There's no grand figures who are the natural heirs. So it's got to be somebody who either is a secret backroom coalition builder or somebody who just is going to emerge suddenly as a successful firebranding politician of politicians.
Yeah.
So do you see anybody out there who's the obvious or not even obvious person?
No. I mean, Paul Ryan, yeah, as you mentioned, but the news of Kevin McCarthy's taking himself out of the race had barely filled one screen of Twitter before Ryan's office had put out the press release saying he wanted to have nothing to do with the job. It's a terrible and difficult job. He thinks he can actually do things that matter in the Ways and Means Committee. And if he has an interest in being president one day, it would be a ruinous job to have because you would just disappoint everyone. And then finally, he's got kids who are of a certain age where he would never see them because the job not only requires dealing with the chaos at the House, but you spend a lot of time out raising money and helping members. So he's not going to do it. Trey Gowdy, who's leading the Benghazi committee, is being asked by some to do it. He's not going to do it. There has been talk of a kind of caretaker speaker, either Candace Miller or John Klein, I think Michigan and Minnesota.
Literally never heard of those people. I must
so
I have to say,
retiring.
Never heard of them.
They're both retiring, and so the idea would be that they would just kind of take care of the House for the next, until the 2016 election. The Republicans would then be able to claim a mandate based on whatever the electoral results were, and then, everybody would kind of get to go forward. The key point to recognize in that is that what that would avoid is basically making anybody take a tough vote. You wouldn't have to vote for a speaker who, voting for Kevin McCarthy alone or voting for John Boehner. Remember, Boehner said when he pulled himself out of the race that he didn't want to make people have to take tough votes, because if you vote for John Boehner to be speaker, the grassroots in your district, whipped up by the people that Boehner called false prophets, will punish you for that vote. So if they're caretakers, nobody has to get punished. Nobody gets a primary race or a primary opponent, pardon me. And you can, operate on your best foot forward for 2016, best foot forward given the chaos that's going on in your party. Now, the problem is, how would you get anything done in the House with a caretaker? The caretaker speaker couldn't enforce, any discipline, and it might be quite chaotic. So anyway, that's what's being floated at the moment. But there's not a lot of there's not an easy fix to this. Now, I should say,
is there any kind of brokered convention scenario, which is that the Speaker of the House does not actually have to be a member of the House? Is there any external Republican who could do it? who people would be like, that would be awesome. And we, you know, Bob Dole is going to come out of retirement to be the 97-year-old
speaker. Yeah, or like a Colin Powell or something. I mean, that is a...
Who would want to do that? Why would Colin Powell, like, in a million years?
Colin Powell is not the... Nor is Bob Dole.
No.
But really,
looking for a wise man. They don't exist anymore, by which I don't mean that there are not wise people around. It's just that the old notion of a wise man was somebody who was kind of above the fray.
Above the fray.
Had the greater interest of the party at hand. And because they had successes and had put a lot into the party in the past in their life, uppity members would bow to their wisdom because of all that they put in for the party. But that system of respect for your elders no longer exists in the party structure. So this person couldn't exist even if we created him.
How about Dick Cheney?
No. So it's a real pickle. Now, I should say, or what I was going to say is, John Boehner's still speaker and will be until they find a replacement. So in a sense, this could be John Boehner's, you know, lifetime employment act, which is that the reason I always scoffed at John Boehner replacement stories is because there was never anybody to replace him. Even when Cantor was in the wings, he could never replace him without Boehner's assent. And now we've just seen proof of why that's the case.
So maybe he's
the caretaker.
Your call on this, John, is that, you're not making a call, but that there's the possibility that we're just going to have an indecision with either Boehner or some other caretaker that gets us a while. Which presumably then you wouldn't have a series of ridiculous showdowns with the president.
Well, you wouldn't have ridiculous showdowns with the president, but you will, because there's a debt limit vote on the debt ceiling vote on the 11th December. Now, one fun piece of news that I heard was that a member from Texas was irritated that the debt ceiling vote was going to happen around the 11th of December because the filing deadline in Texas is the 14th, and so they would have to take the vote about lifting the debt limit before the filing deadline where a primary challenger could sign up to challenge them. So, in other words, you want to take that tough vote after the window has closed for anybody to challenge you, lest your tough vote excite someone to get into the race. So, anyway.
This is just, you know, this is the most ridiculous, dysfunctional legislative system imaginable. This is just wrong. This is not how modern governments work. It is absolutely absurd that we have this. Either the Republicans, we should have a parliamentary system, the Republicans can control the legislature and control the government and act, or not. I mean, that's the only system. This is a non-tenable system. It doesn't work to have these things separated, to have the legislature in the control of one party and the executive branch in control of the other, because it just is a recipe for complete paralysis, toxicity, you know, absurd extreme partisanship. It doesn't make any sense. And this is the point you were just making, Emily, that sort of we heighten the contradictions and look where we are.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is I also feel this wistful fondness for the parliamentary system under which I have never lived. But I also feel like the only way that we get any kind of movement towards structural change or solutions is by making things crack up. And maybe this is a moment of awakening about what happens when you have partisan redistricting to the point where most House races are no longer competitive and there's no reason to have a kind of central core party allegiance anymore. Or at least there isn't enough reason for enough Republicans.
Well, this is going to be fun to watch unfold over the coming weeks, so we will watch it unfold. Okay, let's hear from our first sponsor, which is Casper.com. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses that sell for a fraction of the price you'd pay in a marked-up mattress store. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing the savings directly on to the consumer. Mattresses often cost more than $1,500, but Casper mattresses cost between $500 for a twin, $750 for a full-sized, $850 for a queen-size, and $950 for a king-size mattress. Buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free because Casper offers free delivery and returns within a 100-day period. It is that simple. So what do you get? You get an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price with just the right sink and just the right bounce. You get a risk-free trial and return policy. You get a mattress made in America, and you get great prices, $500 for a twin, $950 for a king-sized mattress. And we have a special offer for GabFest listeners. You get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/political and using promo code political. Terms and conditions apply. Okay, the first Democratic debate will be next week, October 13th in Nevada. It is the first in a limited schedule of six debates. It comes a week before Hillary Clinton testifies to the House Benghazi Committee. Joe Biden has still not decided if he's entering the race, and the debate is going to feature a strange roster of candidates. It will be Hillary Clinton, it will be Bernie Sanders, and then it looks like three other candidates, Lincoln Chafee, Jim Webb, and Martin O'Malley. And we're wondering whether this debate is going to have the same impact on the Democratic campaign, which has been a little bit sleepy, as the extremely entertaining Republican debates have had on that campaign. We are joined for this segment by David Axelrod. You know his name and his face. Of course, he is the director of the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics and the host of a new podcast, The Axe Files, available on iTunes. Welcome, David Axelrod.
Good to be with you guys. Momentous time here. I suggested today in a tweet that the Republicans put the speaker's job up on Craigslist and solicit applicants for it.
Well, anybody can be. Anybody could be the speaker. You could be the speaker. Emily could be the
speaker.
Apparently
not anybody can be. Everybody who lines up for it walks away. It's kind of used to be a pretty good job, but things change.
So we have the first Democratic debate next week. David, you went through the 2008 debates as part of the Obama team.
Yeah.
What does Hillary Clinton need to do in this campaign that she didn't do in 2008 as a debater?
Well, you know, the truth is I thought she was a very good debater in 2007, 2008. I would say she got the best of us in a number of those, and she did pretty well in almost all of them. She had a couple of problems in one specific one I remember in a debate in October of 2007 when the issue of giving driver's licenses to undocumented workers came up, and she kind of stumbled on that one, and everybody pounced on her. And it went to a vulnerability, which is, you know, she went through kind of the political calculations in her head, and it was painfully obvious she was doing it. She has to try and avoid those kind of moments in this debate. But, you know, the truth is she's very fluent. She's very, she presents herself with great clarity. I see this debate as an opportunity for her. And the test will be, can she leave people feeling inspired and good about her candidacy? There's an awful lot of rumbling among Democrats that, you know, she's just not inspiring people to feel good about this. I said a while back that, you know, Hillary, live with it is not a slogan you want to run on. And this is her opportunity to really fire people up a little about her candidacy.
So, Emily, what do you think victory looks like for Hillary, and what does it look like for Bernie Sanders?
Well, Bernie Sanders has an easier task. It's his to win, and he's so dyspeptic and fiery, and I think I'm expecting him to be more fun to watch. So it seems easy to imagine him having moments where he steals the show and gets more of the viral video and TV play the next day. And I think David's right. I feel like there's going to be some moment where Hillary has a choice about whether to just speak straight off the cuff without thinking beforehand about the answer to some question that she hasn't totally already predicted and gamed out. And whatever she says, it should be the first thing that comes to her mind, and it should sound like it comes from her heart. And it almost doesn't matter what she says. If she comes off as having a kind of straight talk, here's how I really feel about this.
The planned spontaneity.
Spontaneity. She's the master of that. She, you know, teased her spontaneity on the front page of the New York Times right before it started.
So, John, you're going to be moderating the second debate, right?
Right.
What is it that you're looking for in terms of how they answer, what their strategy is as a future debate moderator?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think we're going to I suppose something will occur to me at the moment when I watch it. I think by the time our debate is a month later, and so I don't know that I'll be able to pick out that much from this. I guess one thing I would wonder from David is having prepared to go into these both in the primary and in the general. If you're prepping a candidate and you're whether it's Sanders or Clinton, is the job basically, you know, here are the 60 different things you have to tie down, or is it here are three set pieces that you should perform And whenever the moment comes, this is, you know, these are your moments, because we know that the debate will be watched in real time, but it will also be spliced and rewatched and sent around through social media. And so if you can create one or two or three moments that then get passed along, that's almost more powerful than, you know, a seamless 90-minute A to Z performance. Is that right, or how?
Totally right. Totally right. Look, the two things that you do when you're prepping is you want to anticipate the things that are almost certainly going to come, and potential potholes that you need to be aware of. But it is absolutely imperative that you map out those moments that you think will be the moments of the debate that will be the 10 seconds that people cut out and reuse, and that advance some objective of yours, whether it's to show some sort of spirit that you want to advance or make a point on an issue. But, you know, this is the great thing that this is the point that politicians, certainly Obama had problems with this. These are not, you know, trials of fact. These are not side-by-side press conferences. There's a theater element to this, and it's those set pieces that you plan on, that you work on, that you deliver, that often carry the day. Now, sometimes those are genuinely spontaneous moments, but oftentimes they're the things that you prepare for, and you're laying on it, and so, you're waiting for it, and when it comes, you go.
So given that, Dave, or to all of you, if you were Hillary, what set pieces would you be setting up for yourself? What would you be thinking, like, here's where I'm going to get it?
Well, you know, the thing is that what she needs to do, it really is a function of their sense of what their comparative advantages are. In my view, you know, you should build around the things that are genuine. And what she genuinely is a very experienced, pragmatic person who knows how to pursue goals. And I would look for those moments to sort of convey that, you know, this is how the world works, and I know how to get things done in the real world. Because, you know, the truth is that I don't think even Bernie Sanders necessarily believes he's going to be the next president of the United States. I'm not sure. I don't think people are thinking of the other guys on the stage as that. And that's her comparative advantage. People do see her in that role. She has the experience. She has the strength. She just needs to tie it to a sense of where she wants to lead. And I would think she'd want to build a moment around something like that.
What about Emily or John? Do you have thoughts on where she could get her YouTube moment?
I'm so bad at coming up with things like this. I'm only capable of imagining it afterward when it's too late, in that escalator moment kind of way. But surely there's some fodder in her grandmother status, in how long she's been around. I mean, if she could make a Benghazi joke that actually came off or a joke about her email in a way that seemed genuinely remorseful, but also having a little distance from that in a lighthearted way, that would be pretty great.
That seems like a triple bank shot that's pretty tough to hit.
You're not counting on that one, John?
The operative word is genuine. I mean, whatever she does, she has to do it genuinely. She's on like double secret super probation here when it comes to inauthenticity. And I don't think that the position she took on the Trans-Pacific Partnership the other day has helped in that regard, because she's got dozens and dozens and dozens of comments on the record in support of this agreement and this process. And I'm sure she's going to get some barbed questions and comments on that in this debate. She has to be very careful about not looking like she is reading from a script. And as for the grandmother thing, I'm a new grandparent, so I'm partial to these references, but it's become a bit hackneyed. So I just think the biggest thing they have to do is filter everything they do through that authenticity lens, because if she comes off as inauthentic, it's going to just compound what seems to be the core problem facing her right now.
But I don't
think you can filter authenticity through a lens. You just like have to let yourself be you in the moment, and maybe she actually can't plan this. I mean, I feel like we know the moments in the debates that actually are truly unscripted. They're few and far between, but you can feel them when they happen, and people respond to them differently.
Going to the kind of question of the debates as a calendar item, so there are six debates in this primary season. The Republicans have what, like 10? the Democratic debate, because of the nature of the much less interest in the Democratic candidates generally, are going to be much less watched. Do you think it will turn out to be a mistake not to have had more debates and tried to attract more attention to them? They don't seem to be even trying to attract much attention for them in the way that the Republicans clearly want attention for their debates. John?
I wouldn't have minded a few more debates and a little bit earlier. It depends sort of how they play out. I think you could imagine the first one being pretty quiet and everybody kind of focusing on using it as an opportunity to speak directly to the voters and not really engage with each other. And engagement for its own sake, too, is kind of not that interesting. I mean, in other words, if it's just, you know, sort of this person said this about you, and that can kind of get tiresome. So I guess my point is, if we get into like two debates and nothing's been delivered, nothing's been adjudicated, then you are going to have wanted more, maybe.
There was this piece that I can't remember where it was. Some Democrat wrote saying the Democrats have basically sacrificed tremendous amounts of free media time and exposure by not having more debates and by downplaying the ones they have. But you know, putting them on some random, like the ones in March is on PBS, which nobody watches. And the Republicans are just going to get lots more time, lots more exposure, lots more attention. And that's presumably going to accrue to their eventual nominee's benefit.
David may have a different
view. I think that's nuts. I mean, you know, all attention isn't good attention. They got a lot of attention for their debates 4 years ago, and it put Romney in such a deep hole with his own assistants that it rendered his candidacy deeply distressed by the time he became the nominee. And that was the reason they were trying to limit their own debates. Donald Trump has created a tone in these debates that isn't going to redound to the party's benefit in the general election. As for the Democrats, I have a slightly different view in that I actually think if you think of the presidential race as a kind of decathlon, and then there are different kinds of events, speeches and small meetings and so interviews. I actually think debates are one of Hillary's stronger events. You know, I think they've played it conservatively, thinking they don't want to give any oxygen to anybody else in the Democratic race. I think you can either view these things as a challenge or an opportunity. They should view it as an opportunity. But one thing, John, that I disagree with you on is I think that there will be fireworks in this debate. I think they're likely to come from Martin O'Malley, who started off as a serious candidate and is now down in asterisk land and is desperately trying to breathe some life into his candidacy. And I would be shocked if he didn't go hard after Hillary in this debate to try and seize back some of the initiative, particularly on the left, that Bernie Sanders has really stolen from him. He expected to be the alternative candidate to Hillary, and he has been marginalized by Bernie Sanders. He may also go after Bernie, particularly on the gun issue. But I think O'Malley's likely to be the most active person in this debate.
Yeah, that makes sense. He is in need of jumper cables. but I guess staying on that for a moment, he has been so reluctant to say anything mildly abrasive about Hillary Clinton for so long. I mean, he had his one comment about, you know, the presidency's not a crown to be passed. But everyone has tried to get him to make some clear, bright lines, even without attacking her trust or personal, and he's been reluctant. And so I was kind of pricing that into the behavior.
But he went after her the other day on the TPP. And I will say this, he is in a desperate situation. If something doesn't change, he's going to be written out of the script here. So, and I don't think just an energetic presentation of his basic positioning is going to do it for him. He needs to create some tension. Now, the one thing that's challenging for him is that he was one of Hillary's most vociferous supporters back in 2008. My supposition was back then that he saw himself as a potential vice presidential nominee, but he was out there very, very aggressively on her behalf. And the question is, has her record changed so dramatically in these ensuing years that everything he said before is inoperative?
I think that's a good point. Can I ask you one other question, David, which is, what do you make in the calls I've made about Hillary Clinton's position on TPP? I have yet to find someone who's first and full and complete explanation for her opposition to it has been thoroughly political. What's your assessment of her?
Yeah, I mean, I think she made a political judgment. I don't think you can conclude anything other than that, because she was, I mean, she called this the gold standard for trade agreements when she was Secretary of State. And, you know, she can say, well, it drifted from my desires. But as has been reported, they actually strengthened all of these provisions that she's complaining about since she called it the gold standard. So, I mean, I think that, look, there is one strain of thought in politics, is that flip-flopping is fine as long as you flop over onto the popular side. And I think that's the judgment that she's made. I think the potential hazard here is, as I said earlier, she is under such scrutiny for inauthenticity that to flip on something for which she had been a champion really puts a hard spotlight on this whole question. And I think it may cost out against her to having made this choice, but it was a pretty conventional political move, which is to say, you know, the base of the party is not there. Sanders is breathing down my neck. You know, Biden is tied to it, so if he gets in, he'll have to defend it. And I'm going overboard on this thing.
All right, let's go. Last question. You brought up Biden. So how much does this debate plus the Benghazi hearing determine whether Biden comes in?
You know, I think there's something more fundamental here. We all say we appreciate Joe Biden because he's candid and forthright and always tells us what he's thinking. And he's been out there very, very visibly talking about this anguish that he's going through and whether he feels he has the emotional reserves to run for president. I think the drive is there. The ambition is there. I think he resents that Hillary had her path paved for her when he feels like he's at least her equal. I'm sure he thinks he's the guy who has the best experience. And so I think that all of that stuff argues for a candidacy, along with all those people who are blowing smoke his way, some of whom will be throwing daggers as soon as he puts his shoes on the battlefield. But I think he's really wrestling with the emotional toll of running for president. He knows it well because he's done it before and he's been a vice presidential nominee. That, more than anything else, I think is going to determine whether he gets in. I think this is about Joe Biden. It's not about Hillary Clinton or anyone else, and whether he can summon up and his family can summon up, given the tragedy that's beset them this year, whether they can summon up the energy to do this.
David Axelrod, thanks for joining us. Listen to his new podcast. Is your podcast a competitor to us, David?
It is. No, there are no competitors to you guys. I'm just trying to get some crumbs off your table here. No, what I want to do is bring practitioners on. I had Bernie Sanders on as my first podcast and just talk to them as a fellow practitioner about who they are and what motivates them. And these are long form conversations, and I've enjoyed it. I hope other people will listen and enjoy it as well.
That sounds great. That sounds great. All you GabFest listeners who've complained about our Bernie Sanders shortage, you can remedy that at the Axe Files. David Axelrod, thanks for coming over.
Thanks for having me. Good to be with you guys.
Thanks, David.
The GabFest is also sponsored this week by Stamps.com. Getting your mailing and shipping done can seem like a no-win situation, like Kevin McCarthy was in, apparently. Going to the post office takes up valuable time. Leasing a postage meter is expensive with multi-year commitments and hidden fees. But there's a better way, which is Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your desk using your own computer and printer, and even get special postage discounts you can't find at the post office. Plus, Stamps.com is more powerful than a postage meter at just a fraction of the cost. You can save at least 50%, and you'll avoid those time-consuming trips to the post office. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use our promo code GABFEST for a special offer, which has a 4-week trial and a $110 bonus offer, which includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in GABFEST. That's Stamps.com. Enter GABFEST. Jeb Bush, poor old Jeb Bush. The once front runner has now sunk to 5th place in the polls behind the triumvirate of Trump, Carson Fiorina, and then the newly surging Marco Rubio. Jeb Bush has long tried to distance himself from his presidential brother and his presidential father while still also attempting to reap the advantage that he can from their name and fundraising and access and just general getting to start on third base. He has certainly shown a lot of Bush DNA in the past couple of weeks with a run of extremely awkwardly worded, verging on incoherent comments about the Oregon shootings, about African-Americans, about the gold standard. But as he flounders, he is considering bringing his brother George to campaign for him in South Carolina, an important early primary state where George W. Bush remains very popular. Right, George W. Bush remains very popular generally among Republicans. So, Emily, the game theory of this seems to say Jeb Bush benefits in the short term if he brings George W. Bush into campaign for him. It gets sort of some Bush types excited. It aligns them. In the long term, though, it hurts him because in a general election, he will be tied to his brother. Is it actually true, first of all, that it's helpful in the short term, do you think?
I think that it's really striking how strong a politician George W. looks when you consider his strengths up next to the problems that Jeb is having. There's a really good piece on the New Yorker website by Nick Lemon dividing them into kind of right brain passion person, the sort of political animal guy, that being George W. versus the rational Jeb. And it does seem to me like in this series of blunders Jeb has made lately, the free stuff comment, the stuff happens comments, you know, underlying each of those comments is a real view about what the limited power of government ought to be. And yet there's this total tin ear about what you're actually supposed to say to make those kinds of points. And George W. was really good at getting past that with the way he talked. I mean, he really, to go back to our earlier conversation about Hillary Clinton.
Hold on. Pause for Truth Squad. Truth Squading. John Dickerson is giggling. So John
Dickerson.
All right.
You feel like he was Mr. Gaff too, but in a different way, right? I mean, the thing about him was he seemed like he wasn't scripted enough sometimes. Not that he was saying things that, well, I don't know. I'm not making any sense. All right, John, rescue me.
George Bush had a great deal of challenge, as did his father, with the English language. But I think you're trying to put your finger on is a sense that George Bush may have had lots of malaprops and...
But he was just a better politician, right?
Let John finish his thought.
I'm trying to rescue myself.
He was a person who seemed to be engaged in something that he enjoyed, which is to say politics. Right. And Jeb Bush, on the other hand, described himself as an introvert, which is a great thing. I know many of them and count myself among them. But if you're an introvert, politics is the wrong business to go into. I mean, that's not to say there haven't been introverted presidents, but it is a challenge. And it's clear on his face that he does not. He keeps saying he's a joyful candidate, but it is hard to see the joy in his daily labors. Whereas if you look at John Kasich, or you basically look at most of the other candidates, you can see them having some kind of fun. And Donald Trump is the one having the most fun at all different levels, from sending water bottles to Marco Rubio to just the fun he has in the adulation of being in front of a crowd of 20,000. And people used to say this and still do about President Obama, which is, you know, he's a politician who hates politics. And I don't think that exactly fits with Jeb Bush, but I think Jeb Bush, like Hillary Clinton, prefers the governing part, not the campaigning part, and finds the things that he's having to do because of Donald Trump to be distasteful. I mean, you shouldn't have to make an argument for civility and for kind of a reasonable approach to things, but that's what he's having to do. And every time he makes that assertion in his polite and patient kind of way, Donald Trump comes along and says he needs a testosterone shot, which everybody has a big laugh, and Jeb Bush's poll numbers go down.
I remember when we were talking in the very early days, this must be almost 2 years ago now, about Jeb Bush's prospective candidacy. This was something we spent a bunch of time on. This is a guy who has not been active in political campaigning for a dozen years. Not only is it's something he didn't like doing that much when he had to do it in Florida, he wasn't particularly good at it. And also it has radically changed in the past 12 years. And it's evidently clear that he has no stomach for it. And I'm sure if someone told him, like, sorry, there's a law passed. You cannot be president. You are not allowed to run for president. He would be so relieved right now. He would be so happy not to have to be running for president.
So should we brew this? Should we be wringing our hands that this is an example of how the rules for what it takes to become president of the United States right now are making it impossible for the people we'd want to have govern to win?
It is not clear that's true, because as John said, Obama is a little bit this way. And Hillary Clinton is this way, and it's very possible she'll be president.
We don't have to worry. We can just, like, dance on Jeb Bush's grave, hand the nomination over to Marco Rubio, and the Republicans will be better.
Mitt Romney was not a particularly happy warrior. He got the nomination.
And he lost.
No, but he got the nomination.
At least he got through the process. I mean, I go back and forth on whether campaigns tell us nothing about whether a person has the aptitude for the presidency, or whether they just tell us a little, or whether they actually are not a bad proxy for the insanity of the presidency. I think what is true, and I think I've said this before, so I'll do the short version, Donald Trump is presenting each of these other candidates with the kind of challenge you get as president. Weird stuff happens, and it's really powerful and out of your control, and you have to deal with it. And yeah, it wasn't what you were planning for, but tough. That's the job. So there's a crazy, unpredictable, not rational part of presidential campaigns that does give us a tag, does give us some sense of how people will respond, and I think that's what we're seeing here. Now, we should note that there's still a lot of the campaign to go. You know, people who will start to pay attention in the Republican primary process who are not the kind of diehards, so those would probably tend to be better Bush-type voters. He does have a lot of money, and he is a guy who does like policy and can have a, you know, discussion about it. And there may very well turn to a point where they get into a big policy conversation. And it's been clear that when that happens, that's not great for Donald Trump, as we saw in the second debate. So if that time comes, you could imagine that helping Jeb Bush. The notion of George W. going to help him, it surprises me. I mean, particularly as it's been written that it would help him with conservatives. Conservatives are the ones who thought George Bush sold them out, both by expanding the size of government, but also with programs like No Child Left Behind, which was a notion to use government and its benevolence to help the education system, which a lot of conservatives believe is just an impossibility, even as a concept. So the notion that he could somehow come in to help Jeb, I could totally argue it that it comes in to reinforce Jeb's problem, not the legacy issue, but this is another kind of squishy conservative, like the brother, like the father.
Right.
The father, of course, being the author of the tax deal that Jeb Bush thinks is the greatest act of presidential heroism in the modern era, literally. It's a defensible position, but it's not one that conservatives like at all, because it raised taxes in return for shoddy deficit reduction. Or spending reduction. So the math of that still confuses me a little bit. Mention, obviously, the point David made earlier, which is the legacy problem.
It's really hard to see. I mean, two other reasons. One, the legacy problem, which is just that, as you were referring to, I mean, it doesn't look good to have to call on your brother. I mean, think of how Oedipally bad, or I guess not Oedipally, but just to Jacob and Esau, how biblically bad it would feel if you're Jeb Bush and you have to get your older brother's help for this, how much that would make you feel bad and how bad that would look to the public. But also,
and think of the mincemeat Donald Trump is going to make of you and your testosterone level.
And then one other point, just this is in particularly referenced to South Carolina, because South Carolina is a state where George W. Bush beat back John McCain, and George H.W. Bush, I guess, won a primary, probably, no doubt, in the Atwater era. But the South Carolina of today is not the South Carolina of even 12 or 15 years ago when George W. Bush was running. It's a much more conservative, much more hell no caucus kind of state. It's where Trey Gowdy comes from. It is not a state where the sort of medium conservatism that George W. Bush is identified with has a lot of traction. I don't see why this would help Jeb in any real way at all. Seems like it could only be bad. Why do you think, Emily, that Jeb is bearing a higher price for the Bush name than Hillary is bearing for the Clinton name?
Maybe it's because he so much resembles George H., his dad, and Hillary, for whatever her flaws are, she's just not like Bill. So even though, you know, they're linked, she has her whole own when you look at her face, you don't see Bill Clinton and you don't hear his voice when she speaks. And maybe having only one relative who's been the president is different from having two. And then finally, I think being the first woman, she kind of gets a break on the spun.
Right. I also think that the Obama presidency has slightly purged the GOP of its Clinton loathing, that they have so much energy devoted to loathing Obama that they don't actually loathe Bill Clinton anymore nearly as much. That Bill Clinton is,
or at least they've forgotten.
Almost.
They have to gin up their loathing. Surely,
well,
they
loathe. I mean, but let's not underestimate the antipathy towards Hillary Clinton.
No, that's true, but not really towards Bill Clinton. There's an antipathy.
No, in fact, Mitch McConnell uses Bill Clinton as an example of a Democratic president who could work with Congress. I mean, this is a Congress that, or this is a Republican who voted to impeach him, and is saying, well, you know, the good old days where Bill Clinton knew how to make a deal and work with Republicans. So,
it's like Democrats pretending they love Ronald Reagan.
All right, John, last question on this. What is it that Jeb can do about Rubio now? So Rubio does seem to be the big threat to him. They're in the same lane, and Rubio is thriving while Jeb is doing poorly. Is there any specific tactical or strategic thing that he can do that
I think
helps him?
I don't think his beef. I mean, Rubio is on the rise. He's arguably the only candidate other than Ben Carson who has been able to actually run the slow and steady wins the race kind of race. He hasn't done a lot of gratuitous things. He's done well in the debates. He's raised money, and his numbers have slowly been climbing. But I think in the end, Jeb Bush, you know, the case he's making is, I've been in a job where you have to make tough decisions and be a leader. And he just has to stay on that channel. He's never going to be of a new generation, and basically, which is a way to make Rubio's youth and inexperience a problem. And it's not a gratuitous attack. It's the best thing Bush has got going for him. And, you know, he just basically has to kind of stay with that. And I think in the end, it'll be a really interesting conversation because, you know, you look at Rubio and he does look obviously very much like a whole different new generation for the Republican Party. And there's a lot that's attractive in that. And it obviously doesn't, if you ran somebody who doesn't have the legacy problem against Hillary Clinton, it allows you to make the legacy attack against her and so forth. But I also think that, it would be extraordinary that after complaining for so long about a one-term senator with no executive experience, that there would then be a nomination would then go to someone with that same resume.
All right, let's hear from our final sponsor this week, which is Bonobos. Every guy wants to look his best. Few want to put in the effort to maintain a stylish wardrobe. It's very inconvenient. It's a big hassle. It is not easy for somebody like me. Unlike John Dickerson.
Oh, poor you, the fashion challenge.
Well, John, I feel is not fashion. John is stylish. He's a man who knows how to shop. He knows how to buy things. He's a little bit of a dandy. I'm not saying you're a serious dandy, but you're a little bit of a dandy, John. But for somebody like me, not blessed with the face that will launch 1,000 ships and not, you know, just not having instincts.
You're
it's
being
hard.
Too mean to yourself.
It's hard.
I'm interjecting.
And Bonobos, however, take the pain and hassle out of finding stylish clothes that fit. They have clothes for any body type, any fit preference. You can easily browse online through top quality styles from your home. There's free and easy shipping and returns, and there's personable and fast service. I got a really great shirt from Bonobos. I think I've mentioned that before. They have a full line of stylish men's clothing, all meticulously crafted for a better fit. Shirts for the office or the weekend, suits that fit like they've been tailored just for you, jackets and outerwear, ties, belts and shoes, even golf clothes. You can look stylish, feel comfortable, and pick your perfect fit. And for a limited time, all new customers can get 20% off their first order when they go to bonobos.com/gabfest. That's bonobos.com/gabfest to discover the difference that an expertly crafted, better-fitting wardrobe can make. Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you're pondering your House speakership, your run for House Speaker, Emily, this weekend, when you're talking to your maybe your husband, Emily, could run for House Speaker and everyone would think it was Paul Ryan.
That's a great idea.
And they'd be like, they're both named Paul. Paul with a two-syllable last
everybody.
Name.
It would
fool everybody. Wait, but I thought it was Paul. It's not Paul Ryan? And then he could sneak past his radical liberal agenda.
And then he could use the House floor to deliver lectures about, you know, natural resources and environmental history.
It would be awesome.
Okay.
What are you going to chatter about?
I'm going to chatter about this very funny and winning essay that a colleague of mine at the Times Magazine, Jasmine Hughes, wrote for Lenny Letter, which is the new Lana Dunham vehicle that our former colleague and friend Jess Gross is editing. And so
and
Shirley
I'm advising,
Jess,
I should say.
And that you're advising, sorry. Of course, that's crucial to mention. I can't. So either Jasmine or Jess surely gets credit for this great headline. I bled through my pants on my first day at a new job. So that new job was Jasmine's first day at the New York Times. And the bleeding through her pants, I mean, let's just say many female creatures in the universe have experienced this moment of terror when they have their period. And Jasmine just does a really...
Like female creatures in the universe?
Yeah, I was gonna
Do other
say,
female creatures
wear
pants?
How many antelopes are wearing pants?
All right, fine. Maybe it's just humans. I imagine that maybe elsewhere in the animal universe, they somehow share this sense of panic. But maybe you're right, and
it's
just humans.
I know, but they're not so clothed in the animal universe.
All right, fine. Maybe I've taken my anthropomorphism a little too far. All I have to say is this is a common problem. When it's happening to you, it's awful and humiliating. And Jasmine does a fabulous job of making fun of it. And I just love that, like, we live in a world in which you can write this essay and it can be good for your professional life as a writer. So go, Jasmine, and you guys should go read. You can Google it and it'll come up.
And if you're the parent of a daughter, and just the demystifying and the excellent, I don't know, it's great.
Oh, good. I'm glad you had that response to it. The men in my house weren't sure whether they wanted to read the whole thing.
All right, John, top that with some historical blood.
I seek not to. So my chatter was is about Jimmy Carter, who is mediating. Jimmy Carter, we know, is suffering from cancer and is undergoing treatment from that. And we also know that he is the catalyst for the historic agreement in 1979 between the Israelis and the Egyptians that found peace between those warring nations. And also he did some peace negotiations with the Soviets, is now brokering peace between Dr. Martin Luther King's offspring, who have been in a famous and long-standing fight over whether they can sell their father's possessions. And what basically is at issue is that some of the kids want to sell their possessions, and then the daughter, Bernice King, has argued that the items are sacred, including the Bible and his Nobel Prize, are sacred and also belong to the mother and therefore shouldn't be sold. Because, in other words, if they were to belong to the father, then they would be under this different trust. Anyway, there have been suits and countersuits and lawsuits. But now Carter, age 91, who is being treated for cancer, is also going to try to adjudicate the spat inside the King family. And he said, I believe that we will be able to resolve these difficult disputes once and for all, which sounds exactly like, as my colleague Louise at CBS said, it sounds exactly like he's talking about the peace accords in 1979. So Jimmy Carter, at the end of his life, always still committed to finding peace among disputing factions.
One of my first stories for Slate was about Dexter King, who was one of the sons, then the kind of most aggressive monetizer of the King legacy. Did not make me fall in love with the King family. It is not, they have not, I think, handled their father's legacy as well as can be. It's a bit of a mess there.
Well, Dexter King had already sued Bernice King, saying that she was not taking good care of these items, and that suit I think was dropped. It was one of the many suits, but it was dropped ultimately.
Okay, before my chatter, I just want to tip you off about a great job at Slate. If you love Slate, you love podcasts, obviously, because you're listening to this one. We have a job available, Slate senior producer job open. You are a talented person with skills who loves podcasts and wants to be part of the amazing Slate podcast empire. Go to slate.com/jobs and get more info, and we look forward to working with you. My chatter, I can't decide what my chatter should be. Carly Fiorina or Standing Desks? Which one?
Standing Desks.
Standing
Love
Desks.
The Standing Desks.
So great story this week that the Obama administration has put in a requisition for Standing Desks for the White House, which is great. I love that fact. I work now at a Standing Desk. I've said to my Slate colleagues that if I'd known that Standing Desks were available, I probably would have stayed at Slate longer if I'd been able to have a Standing Desk, because I love working at Standing Desk so much. But the interesting thing to me was they've put in to get Standing Desk for the White House, the budget ask is $700,000. Which is
they must be getting the kinds that go up and down, which are much more expensive than if you just have a plain old Standing Desk.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying it's they're getting more than 1,000 of these probably, but that's a lot. That's I mean, I'm all for it. I think it's great, but that's a lot of money for the country to spend on standing desks. But then again, we're probably spending it on. I guess if you have a standing desk, also you maybe don't need an expensive office chair, so maybe you get a savings there.
You get
Then they have their expensive office chairs already.
It's the famous office chair dividend.
Do you guys work at standing desks?
I do. I have one both at the office and at home.
Do you have a chair?
Yeah.
I just moved my chair out of the way.
The chair is.
But
kind
I find
of a
that
one.
Price tag to be really suspicious because the one I have in my office cost was super cheap. It doesn't go up and down, but like you know, I got it on Amazon for like I can't remember less than $300.
Yeah, that's.
And then the one I have at my house, my 15-year-old just like constructed this, you know, kind of somewhat mostly sturdy T-shaped thing with plywood that just sits on top of my regular desk.
You know, but I'm sure it's that because it has to meet whatever OSHA standards are and it has to go up and down and there are all sorts of things about, you know, the
Well, why
angle.
Would it have to go up and down to meet OSHA standards? That doesn't
well,
make sense
Well, because
if
your people are different heights and so they have to be, it has to work for somebody who is 5'2" and also someone who's 6'3" and therefore...
Really? You don't think that everyone just has their own desk and that, I mean, maybe, I don't know.
I don't know.
But aren't you making an argument against big government, David?
I don't know what I'm making an argument about. I was just delighted that they're getting a bunch of standing desks. No doubt this will become a subject of controversy whenever the new president, if it's a Republican president, they'll throw out all the standing desks. It's
a bonfire
plot.
Of standing
It'll be
desks.
A commie plot of desks. All right. That was a good, fun show. Our intern is Tark Barrett, just for a little bit longer. We're getting just close to hiring a new intern. Our producer.
And we are so sad that Tark is leaving.
Yes. Well, he hasn't left yet, so don't let's
well, I know,
save your
the
tears.
The thought of it makes me sad.
Our producer is Jason DeLeon. Andy Bowers is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. The GabFest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/gabfest. Our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest, and our email address is gabfest@slate.com. Please subscribe to the GabFest on iTunes. Leave a comment and rating. That really help. For Emily Bazelon, John Dickerson, and David Plotz, we'll talk to you next week.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next, and I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.